So for those who are listening who are not familiar with acceptance and commitment therapy or training, can you explain what it is and why it's different from traditional behavior analysis?
Well, first of all, something that is difficult for people to kind of wrap their heads around is that we call it ACT as opposed to ACT because it's about action. It's about putting one foot in front of the other. It evolved in the 1980s from the work of behavior analysts who were also clinical psychologists, but they were dyed-in-the-wool behavior analysts in the sense that they were rooted in the philosophy of science that Skinner had trotted out. Skinner was unusual in that he was a scientist who recognized the importance of articulating your assumptions, your pre-analytic assumptions. So Skinner assumed that behavior is orderly and lawful. Skinner assumed that behavior is not under the control of internal events, but is under the control of the external environment. And Skinner assumed that all behavior, even that which is very subtle, very difficult to see, what he called within the skin or covert or private behavior, is in fact behavior that comes under the control of the environment. In the 1980s, the experimental analysis of behavior began to move into the experimental analysis of human behavior. That was always Skinner's dream. It was never to be a science of the behavior of rats. It was to be a science of all behavior, ultimately aimed to influence culture and save the planet. When the experimental analysis of human behavior began to examine the way human reactions to schedules of reinforcement become less predictable, researchers began to recognize that sometimes we respond to rules in ways that blind us to the direct contingencies of reinforcement. That is, we become insensitive. Our behavior desensitizes to the contingencies of reinforcement and acts with respect to a rule. Sometimes those rules are rules that people tell us. Other times, those rules are things that we tell ourselves. Other times, they're rules that we were told long ago that we don't even remember when those rules were told to us, but we stick to them like glue. That can be very helpful in many circumstances, and also it can be very detrimental in some circumstances. So as the experimental analysis of human behavior began to trot out these reactions to rule-governed behavior, simultaneously, or these rule-governed reactions to self-talk, simultaneously, another branch of basic research investigating equivalence was emerging. And some researchers, Steve Hayes, Aaron Brownstein, Rob Zettel, who was Steve's very first grad student, began to examine other forms of relating. Relating in terms of opposition, in terms of distinction, in terms of hierarchy, in terms of causality, in terms of perspective, in terms of time, in terms of place, which had the same effect upon behavior, such that when you relate one thing to another that are totally dissimilar physically, with a cue that you learn physically, let's say you learn that this is bigger than this, that's easy enough to learn physically, but then you learn that this is way bigger than this in certain contexts. That extends the knowledge of equivalence and provides the context by which we have the tools to undermine the power of rules and give people the flexibility or give people the tools with which to develop flexibility about their self-talk. So these branches of basic science were emerging, and it led to the development of comprehensive distancing. That was the original name for ACT, comprehensive distancing. I'm sure glad they got rid of that name, right? But that was what it was called. And it kind of suggests like that with regard to yourself and time and rules and emotions and action, you're able to distance from yourself and see yourself and make wise decisions about how you're going to relate to the world, thus bringing your behavior back under the control of relevant contingencies of reinforcement. That was how it began. And it began by behavior analysts who were practicing psychotherapy. I think Steve Hayes and his colleagues very early on kind of recognized that a long-range goal was to take this out of the hands of psychotherapists and put this into the hands of people who have a wider branch of people who could be influenced by it. Nurses, doctors, community organizers, activists, behavior analysts. And so I wasn't the very first, but there were a couple of people who came before me who were behavior analysts. I didn't know about them until I had started developing an iteration of ACT that is useful for applied behavior analysts to make use of. So I had come to behavior analysis after having a career in teaching and then a career in outdoor adventure therapy, in outdoor adventure programming, using the wilderness as a metaphor for all things that are really important in life. So using rock climbing and using backpacking and orienteering as metaphors for trust, responsibility, risk-taking, and the stewardship of the land. So when I discovered behavior analysis, I just totally loved it and wanted to go back to grad school. I was already in my 40s. It was a little late in life. And I started reading and I came across Steve Hayes' work. I was like, wow. Oh. Steve is using metaphors and physicalizing them to help people get unstuck. Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I was doing when I was doing outdoor adventure therapy. And so I knew that I wanted to develop iterations of ACT that would be suitable for use by applied behavior analysts. And that was the beginning of my work in acceptance and commitment training. Steve actually coined that term in 2004 before I actually came into it. And DJ Moran was around. He's both a clinical psychologist and a board-certified behavior analyst doing safety consulting. There was Heidi Eilers, who was one of Steve's students before I came around, who is a behavior analyst who was using ACT inside of autism clinics. So I wasn't the very first, but I didn't know about anybody else. And so I started developing these tools. And the bottom line, to directly answer your question, is that what we all went to grad school and learned was the ways to manipulate discriminative stimuli and consequences and contrive motivating conditions to improve the probability of desired behavior and reduce the probability of non-desired behavior to improve learning and to help people flourish, to behave more successfully. In other words, we learned how to manipulate the external environment. And it seems like a natural extension of all of that to be able to make use of the findings from the experimental analysis of human behavior to help people whose behavior has come under the influence of their own self-talk. When your self-talk creates the conditions under which you've got blinders over your eyes and you can't see the changes in the contingencies to your left and to your right, that's when it becomes important to have a advanced verbal behavior intervention that helps you to remove the blinders so that you can see the way the world is changing and shifting around you so that you can respond nimbly and be more effective in your environment. So that's how this kind of differs, in the sense that we learned direct contingency management in grad school. Now we're beginning to trot out how to respond to indirect acting contingencies or to private interfering behavior.
Yeah, thank you for that. You know, that's interesting. I want to get into that whole history of ACT that was rooted within behavior analysis back in the 80s, but is now just coming onto the scene for many behavior analysts, and why that is. But first, I really want to touch on, you know, for the past two decades, you've been teaching and researching and publishing and legitimize ACT for ABA practitioners. You've recently published your comprehensive manual. It's called ACT and Behavior Analysis, and then started your own company called ACT Now ABA. Can you tell us more about these projects? And would you consider this more of a culmination of your life's work, or you know, a start of a new beginning?
No, definitely a culmination of my life's work. Yeah. I mean, I kind of knew very early on that I loved what I discovered when I finally late in life found applied behavior analysis and wanted to do that for my life's work. But I also kind of saw the opportunity to bring in what I had developed in outdoor adventure programming. I guess what I kind of saw very early on was that there would be some pretty strong resistance to that in the applied behavior analysis world, because the way that ACT developed a languaging about these things was, it just sounds mentalistic, you know, to talk about mindfulness, to talk about transcendence, to talk about cognitive diffusion and experiential avoidance. It didn't seem like that was going to be an easy sell to the kind of hardcore scientific applied behavior analysis world. So I began to think, okay, well, how am I going to present this in a way that it doesn't get squashed? I mean, I kind of like had this idea that, okay, well, I can learn to be a really solid, articulate applied behavior analyst, and I can learn how to be an academic about it and to describe it technologically for other people in a way that that is suitable, so that maybe if I'm lucky, the powers that be don't come and squash me like a bug. But I kind of figured that they were going to figure that I'm a quack, and they would just, you know, I'd be really lucky if they left me alone, you know, like. Mm-hmm. You know, if they just kind of like put me inside of a little matchbox and close it and like let me do my thing inside of my matchbox, and they don't come and squash me, like, yay, I get to live, I get to do what I do. I had no idea that the whole thing was going to grow and explode, but it did. There were a lot of things along the way that included my having the opportunity to share an office with a couple of people who were very influential in the field. I got a job working with Florida Institute of Technology, and we had a contract with Center for Autism Related Disorders. Jonathan Tarbox was a director of research and development. He's a close friend of mine and a climbing partner of mine. And both of us were interested in private events. So we had an opportunity to work with each other and to cross-pollinate our skills. And I started introducing him to ACT as something that applied behavior analysts could do. He had known about ACT, he'd gone to UNR, but he didn't think that it would fit inside of applied behavior analysis. And I started like kind of massaging that idea in. And once he saw it, then it grew. And I had no idea that it was going to grow the way it did. I'm really excited that it did. But, you know, now like the whole trajectory of my work has been to make sure that as we trot this thing out, we do so in a way that is going to be consistent with our scope of practice, that is going to be familiar in procedure to what you and I learned in graduate school, yeah, to all of the people who learned applied behavior analysis in grad school, to those who learned, if you zoom out, there's four domains of a science. There's the philosophy of science, there's the basic research, which is aimed at uncovering the rudimentary principles. There's the applied science, which takes basic principles and translate them into what people need to flourish in their worlds. And then there's practice, which is kind of its own wing. So there's four different pillars of a science. Most of us kind of like narrow into applied behavior analysis, but I was trained and Jonathan was trained and my other colleagues who I've developed this with were trained in all four pillars. So behavior analysis is much bigger than applied behavior analysis. But the domain of applied behavior analysis and its practice, those two domains, wow, like it's really important that they stay coherent within some set of rules. So Beowulf and Risley in 1968 developed what they called our some current dimensions of applied behavior analysis. That was 51 years ago, 52 years ago, something like that. And when they developed those ideas, the applied science was in its infancy. So it made sense to kind of like narrow it down and restrict what our focuses were within this field. It never changed. It probably kind of needs to be expanded out just a little bit at this point, because now we have some technology for dealing with the effects of private behavior. We don't have any means even today to actually change what somebody says to themselves privately. That's never been a goal of ACT. It still isn't a goal of ACT, whether you do ACT as psychotherapy or whether you do ACT as applied behavior analysis. We don't really have the tools to change how you talk to yourself. But we do have the tools by which to analyze how you talk to yourself as products of previous verbal behavior. Right. And as products of previous verbal behavior, what you have said to yourself, those rules, well, now they are discriminative stimuli. They are reinforcers or they are punishers. They are part of the environment in which you operate. They have influence. Again, we don't have a whole lot of ability to directly manipulate them, but we can indirectly manipulate them. So my focus has been on developing a conceptualization of that that is consistent with how we articulate things in behavior analysis, and a technology for doing that that would be somewhat familiar to people who went to school and learned how to contrive motivating operations to make SDs very salient and to immediately consequate with reinforcers, mostly positive reinforcers, but wherever necessary, negative reinforcement and punishment. Well, so it really has been a culmination of my life's work to bring together what I learned as a teacher, what I learned as an outdoor educator, and what I learned in applied behavior analysis and in behavior analysis more broadly. Now,
it's fantastic that we have this now tool, this verbal tool to analyze language beyond what Skinner had hoped. I guess if Skinner had lived long enough, it would his analysis of verbal behavior would have developed into relational frame theory, what we know today. I guess it was leaning that way. Anybody who is a behavior analyst, let me just ask, when can they apply the ACT principles? When is it appropriate to use ACT as opposed to traditional behavior analysis?
Let me just like start by saying, I don't know what Skinner would have done had he lived another 20, 30 years. It's hard to say.
Yeah.
I would hope that he would have opened up to RFT in their early conversations. I don't think Skinner was very amenable to it, but I don't know. There were certain things that Skinner wrote. I could read you passages where it's very clear that he recognized that the analysis was going to need to broaden out. And when Steve Hayes wrote a book on rule-governed behavior and invited Skinner to write a chapter on the listener, Skinner began to talk in ways that have some congruence, some intersection with RFT. So I don't know what would have happened down the road. My guess is that Skinner probably would be comfortable with ACT, less comfortable with RFT, but I don't know. What I have been telling my students for the last couple of years is that there may come a time when we've established enough research that we can easily and comfortably say with confidence that everything goes better for clients who have verbal skills when you begin with ACT. We're not there yet. We don't have that body of research yet. Our applied behavior analysis research on ACT is still in its infancy. So kind of the way I think it is most defensible for us to operate right now is do what you learned in grad school initially. Hmm. You know, if your aim is to reduce unwanted behaviors, begin by identifying what that behavior is. Do a functional assessment, a functional analysis if you have the tools and resources to do a functional analysis, develop a function matched treatment, and see if that influences behavior. If it does, no reason to do any ACT. If that doesn't, and your client doesn't have verbal skills, well, you know that you got to go back and redo your functional assessment and your functional analysis. Mm-hmm. But if your client does have verbal skills, then maybe you might hypothesize it's possible that some of their self-talk is getting in the way. Well, at that point, then it makes sense to do an ACT functional assessment and an ACT functional analysis, and then develop an ACT intervention based on the results of your assessment. There's six different general categories of interfering behavior that we focus on in ACT. And you can throw the entire kitchen sink at a problem, like, you know, do like interventions for all six of them, or you can throw spaghetti at the wall and just say, I think it's this, and let's try it and see if it reduces the, you know, brings behavior back under a stimulus control. But that's not consistent with applied behavior analysis. Right. We neither throw the kitchen sink at things, nor do we, package interventions are fine, but if you use a package intervention, the onus is on you to do a dismantling study to identify what's the most important putative ingredient in that. Likewise, throwing spaghetti at the wall, that's completely inconsistent with applied behavior analysis. We are analytic and precise and efficient in our strategies. So it makes sense to have developed a good applied behavior analytic functional assessment and functional analysis procedure for uncovering the most important of the six repertoires of behavior that is getting in the way of your direct contingency management. Treat that with an ACT intervention, and then go back to the direct contingency management stuff. So in my view, when to do ACT? When your direct contingency management isn't gaining traction. It's kind of like your vehicle is stuck in the mud. What do? Do you keep on spinning your wheels? No, you get out of your car, you find some cardboard, you stick some cardboard underneath the wheels to get it unstuck. Well, that's what ACT is. ACT is the cardboard that you're sticking underneath the wheels of your truck to get it unstuck so you can get your car back on the road. Do you still need the cardboard? Maybe you need to keep it in the car just in case you get stuck in the mud again. But you don't need to use cardboard all the time.
Yeah. Good point. Now, I want to move on to, so you've got on your website, ACT Now ABA, your new company. You've got a new training called Capture a Cloud. It's a 4-day in-person ACT training intensive workshop in Las Vegas, starting January 11th through the 14th. And it looks massive. And there's both day sessions and evening sessions, right? So how is this, well, what is this training all about? How is it different from other traditional trainings?
Well, I don't know what traditional is, but when ACT Boot Camp began in, while I was still in grad school, and Steve Hayes, Kelly Wilson, Robin Walzer, Jay Luomo would put together a 4-day boot camp. Each one of them took a day and kind of did their own thing. And, you know, later people swapped out. Sometimes it was DJ Moran. Sometimes it was Emily Sandoz or Matt Boone. And, you know, each trainer had their own spin on introducing ACT. And that was cool for psychologists who took that. Then we developed ACT Bootcamp for behavior analysts, and we used basically the same model. So each one of us kind of took something like functional assessment or ACT Pro Social or working with parents or working with kids or working with people with intellectual and developmental disabilities or working with autistic people. And all of us being experts in our particular branches and our particular areas, we just kind of did our own thing. And so there was a lot of overlap, and then there was a lot of like divergence, and that divergence is kind of cool because people got to see there's different ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. And there was a downside, and the downside has been that people leave saying, this is outstanding, this is wonderful, this is awesome, and I don't know where to begin. I need more training. And it has struck me as being an unfortunate byproduct of the model that people spend the money to come to a 4-day workshop and fly and stay in a hotel and eat and all of this. And then, it's a lot of money to spend and leave and not have the tools to start using this stuff when you leave and go back to work.
Yeah.
And so I start to think that maybe it would be useful for us to develop one single way of doing the whole thing. And it's not necessarily the best way to do it. It's not the only way to do it. It's just a way that is consistent and coherent across a 4-day training that provides people with enough consistency that come Monday morning, they can hit the ground running. They're still going to need some consultation. They're still going to need somebody to help guide them and keep them within their lane, their scope of practice, and to build their scope of competence further from what it is at the end of the 4 days. But they'll have enough to start right away, having learned one consistent model over the 4 days. The other thing is, in addition to using behavior analytic tools for teaching, like errorless discrimination, fading the prompts, coaching, behavior skills training, in addition to all of that, which fundamentally like narrows your repertoire, brings your behavior under discriminative control, and gives you a foundational practice active repertoire. Then the next step is to program for generalization. How do we take this? And this is, I think, like the heart of my company is like envisioning that ACT has been kind of developing for since the late middle 1980s. And it's relatively good technology, but now it's kind of at a point where now it needs to branch out and expand, and it needs to evolve in ways that are going to be suitable for different populations. It has been at the heart of ACT Now ABA, the company that I founded along with many of my colleagues and friends, that this is a we thing. This is about us together creating the context for re-envisioning ACT, to reimagining it to be of serviceable dimensions, to work inside of the Black liberation community, to work inside of the autistic community, to work inside of the indigenous community, to work inside of the recovering alcoholic and substance use community, to work inside of the recovering domestic violence community. These are all places where applied behavior analysts are beginning to work with people who have verbal skills and who get stuck in ways outside of the direct contingencies of reinforcement. And it doesn't make any sense to me that somebody who looks like me and has my life history develops a treatment for people that don't look like me and don't have my life history. It makes all the sense in the world to me that we together get together and build something new as a team. And so the evening sessions are about, like, if the day sessions are about bringing your repertoire to bear in simple context, the evening sessions are about generalization and programming for people to begin taking this technology and reimagining it, changing it, suiting it to fit in diverse contexts.
Yeah, that's great. What is your hope then, when people come to this training, that they also network and they just continue, it continues from there?
Yeah, for sure. Like, for example, Denisha Gingles is one of our evening presenters, and Denisha's going to do, like, one of the evenings, she's going to be doing stuff along the lines of Black liberation in behavior analysis, but one night is going to be just for Black attendees. I think that, I'm a rock climber, and I've been a rock climber for 50 years, and one of the, like, things that was happening in the 1980s, like, before most people even knew what rock climbing was. Like, you know, I've been telling people since 1980s, 1970s that I'm a rock climber, and they say, oh, I go climbing too. I went hiking last weekend in the Catskills. And I'm like, nah, it's not rock climbing. You know, but like, so in the early days, it was mostly men. And men really wanted to bring their girlfriends and their wives along. And it was just horrible watching men and women climbing together, because men would try and teach using the kinds of ways of socializing and teaching that were comfortable to them that they had been brought up with. And it just didn't work. And women started to develop their skills, but then they realized that they would do so really effectively if they just were, like, climb together. And so women in like, who were, like, really, like, developing good climbing skills started climbing independently of men. And that's when their skills started to flourish. And it just seems like that's a reasonably good model, that, like, for Denisha to do that with Black attendees at our audience. And that may happen with the autistic community as well, I kind of hope, as well, and other communities as we evolve. So yes, networking seems to be a really, really important part of this particular training model. So you can do all kinds of trainings online, and you can build community online. It's 10 times more powerful to build community and network in person.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, we're certainly, like, now at a place where we're able to build community online, but it's still not the same as when
It's not the same. It's not the same. And what I particularly like about Capture a Cloud is you really focus on not just implementing, teaching and implementing ACT for a homogenous group of people, like, we're all the same. It's a recognition that we have a lot of diversity, and that that ACT needs to be specialized and tweaked according to that group that's, you know, that may be a marginalized group. And so there's a lot of focus on that in this training.
It's if you look at applied behavior analysis research published from very early on until like the last couple of years, most participant descriptions have been limited to scores on the ADOS or scores mm-hmm. on some type of reading test, the age yeah. of somebody, and no reference to culture, no yeah. reference yeah. to whether people yeah. read in the household, whether people tell stories in the household, whether people build things and take things apart in the household, whether people's culture is driven by this member of the family or that member of the family. These things matter. And
yeah.
Yeah. So we've kind of like very recently come out of what is our equivalent of a colorblind ideology.
Yeah.
I mean, I think yeah. that the idea that humans evolve from other species and therefore all of us respond to the same fundamental learning principles is good up until a certain point. But then at some yeah. point, that's no longer useful. We really need to be able to identify the strengths that are within a particular cultural background that we can draw upon
yeah.
as we yeah. help somebody.
Totally agree. Yeah. I mean, that I don't want to spend too much time on this, but that reminds me that, you know, there's so much politics associated with those with our thoughts about different groups and how to respond and so forth. But this steers away from the politics and looks through a scientific lens of what people need, what individuals need in order to thrive today.
Yeah.
Yeah. My understanding is that the pricing for this training is flexible. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, we got it's not going to be flexible very much longer. We had early bird rates, and uh-huh. there you can if you register like this weekend, you'll still get in on the early bird rates, but they're going away pretty soon. Okay. There will be kind of specials that will run periodically if you like keep looking out for me on social media and my colleagues on social media, but there are a couple of really good things. Number one is we have a tremendously low registration fee for students. And that's because we have a commitment. And our commitment is that the people who really need to get this are the next generation oh. of practitioners. And so we want to see students in the room. They're going to put pressure on their universities to include formal coursework on this stuff, and enough pressure on universities, then when professors get asked to be content experts at the BACB, they will go and say, it's probably time for us to introduce this inside of the task list. Mm-hmm. We are making very nice deals for groups. So if there's three of you, contact me and we'll cut you a good deal to get you in. We've got 12 scholarships we have filled. If we got like a ridiculously high number of registrations, we'd open up more scholarships. But right now we're able to cover the 12 that we have. And we had a really, really cool process by vetting the scholarship applications. And I'm so pleased that the 12 who we're including in the workshop. Yeah.
Oh, cool. Yeah. And how can they reach out to you? Is it through the website actnowaba.com?
Yeah. And my email is, you can reach me at info@actnowaba.com or.
Yeah, and I'll post that. It'd be helpful.
Yeah, that would be great. And you can also contact me at tom@actnowaba.com.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Anything else that I missed about Capture Cloud or the company?
It's business unusual. I mean, it really yeah. is business unusual. Our aim is to expand, our broader aim is to expand the technology that applied behavior analysts have at their disposal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's run like a nonprofit.
Yeah.
You're moving into a, was it Class B corporation or B corporation?
Yeah, well, I mean, I formed the company as a limited liability corporation. So I'm the founder, but I run it like a nonprofit. I have a board of advisors. I don't make any decisions by myself, but the board includes students. It includes a trans man. It includes an autistic woman. Both are just extraordinary leaders in their own right, and several academics, including Nasia Cirincione Ulazi, Kendra Thompson, Jonathan Tarbox. This group kind of guides and steers what the organization does on the basis of a set of values that we've all kind of like written about on our own. So we have done some valuing exercises that helped us to articulate for ourselves what we most cherish and aim to make our decisions on the basis of as we move forward. So either, you know, it depends how things in the economy go. We could transition this into being a nonprofit organization, or we could keep it as it is, but apply for certification as a B corporation. B corporations are committed to transparency, to economic sustainability, and to social justice. So those are all consistent with our values, and it's an extended process to become a B Corp. So I'm not sure what the future governance of the company is, but right now I'm pretty satisfied that our advisory board makes really good decisions on the basis of those values that we've articulated.
So, you know, moving on to pro-sociality, and you've been, you know, Skinner was big with the idea that ABA or behavior analysis, wanted to develop a science of behavior, let's put it that way, to save the world. And so ABA is a big part in pro-sociality, and you have a big part in that as well. What is your role, and where do you think that your company is going to be leading the movement?
I don't know about a big part. I'm a bit player, and I don't know about movements per se. And it's actually kind of weird for me to say, because I've been involved in political movements ever since I was 16, 17 years old. I'm not terribly comfortable with talking about ACT for Socialism movement. Paul Atkins talks about it that way, and he sees it that way, and that's cool. But I got involved a little bit earlier. I got involved in like around 2010, 2011. And that, again, the way this whole thing evolved is kind of interesting, because Steve Hayes was really interested in following some of the breadcrumbs that B.F. Skinner had left behind about the parallels between behavioral selection and natural selection and cultural selection. Mm-hmm. And Tony Bigland introduced him to David Sloan Wilson, who is preeminent evolutionary scientist, who had been developing a way of conceptualizing cultural selection, behavioral selection, and natural selection, who was familiar with B.F. Skinner's work, and who had been developing a new synthesis of evolutionary scientific principles, along with E.O. Wilson, who is not related to David Sloan Wilson, but they had been kind of like arguing about like how much it would be possible to do this kind of cultural level selection. And for many, many years, collegially arguing about this stuff. And then along came Eleanor Ostrom. Eleanor Ostrom was a resource biologist in California who saw in her work something that was completely unpredicted, that companies sharing the underground waterway in Los Angeles were cooperating with each other, were helping each other, were not needing a government to control how they interacted with each other, and were not operating on a zero-sum game, one winner takes all. They were coexisting and cooperating with each other. It was very unpredicted. And she thought this as being really, really exciting because it contradicted the current wisdom of the time, which was encapsulated in Garrett Hardin's 1968 thought experiment that he called the tragedy of the commons. The idea being that if we have some common land and a bunch of us kind of live around the land, we can agree to use it together and put, like, you know, agree upon limits for each other. But none of us are going to stick by those limits. And each of us is going to ultimately behave selfishly, which thus requires the coercive oversight of a regulatory government. That was Hardin's conclusion, and most people bought that conclusion. The other alternative conclusion is, well, we let them do what they do, and in a zero-sum game, the winner takes all and then is kind and beneficent and helps the others to move on and do something else. That was the thinking of the day. But Ostrom found something very different in Los Angeles. And so she went to Stanford to go to grad school and got a Fulbright scholarship to travel around the world and look at what small shared pool resource communities did. And she found that there were 8 core principles of self-organization within a group, that if groups did these 8 things, they wouldn't just survive, they would thrive, they would do really well. And when David Sloan Wilson read Eleanor Ostrom's Nobel Prize winning thesis, he had this like instant recognition that that's what we need in this linkage of evolutionary science and behavior science. And so he contacted Steve Hayes, and they contacted Eleanor Ostrom and asked her, would you be willing to scale this thing up from small shared pool resource communities to schools, hospitals, behavioral clinics, all of these places that we exist in the so-called developing world? And she said yes. And so they all started working together on this. Unfortunately, Dr. Ostrom died in 2012, but this is already kind of like in motion. So I got involved in like 2010, 2011, and started pitching pro-social in some of the groups that I was doing organizational behavior management with. And it occurred to me that some of what we do in OBM is hard for people to actually do. Like, everyone kind of wants to have contingencies managed, but nobody really wants to have their contingencies managed by anybody else. And nobody wants to necessarily manage everybody else's contingencies. So there's certain aspects of OBM that's a little bit aversive to everybody. And in some ways, some aspects of OBM over time kind of began to move towards, not all OBMers, but in some ways, some aspects of OBM began to move towards helping the managers and helping the owners, and not so much the line staff. Not an intended outcome of OBM, but it sometimes can be seen. ACT Pro Social occurred to me as being something that could be combined with OBM contingency management to bring about the conditions under which people identify what they truly value and work together collaboratively to identify how we're going to share resources, how we're going to manage conflict, how we're going to make decisions, how we're going to deal with desired behavior, how we're going to consecrate desired behavior, how we're going to consecrate undesired behavior, how we're going to, how much independence are we going to give in small groups within our larger community, and how we're going to interact with other communities that are our competitors or are the externalities to our own corporation.
Yeah.
Well, these principles, like if you develop some flexibility with everybody in the group and then start talking through these things and then create a small subgroup that's responsible for developing a implementation plan. An implementation plan with responsibilities and accountabilities and timelines and if-thens and so on and so forth that report back to the visioning group periodically to say this is how it goes, that is in direct communication with human resources and legal. Like in large corporations, in small corporations, mid-sized corporations across most of North America where I work, we have human resources and legal teams, and they need to be involved in these decisions. And so you can't just kind of like, you know, have a group of practitioners making these decisions and then like enacting them. There's some like steps that you got to walk through in order to make that happen. So the better idea is to bring them in from the very beginning. Well, so I started doing that in 2011, 2012, before I graduated, and I've been doing that ever since. But I don't like to look at it as a movement. I like to look at it as the scientific evolution of OVM, and developing the data is something that we're still kind of struggling with, and we're doing the best that we can. We're working really hard to develop the data that show how you do what you do to make that work. It's still an evolution, but I think that we've got we've made some progress.
Where do you start? Is that training that you're offering a good place to start if you're fresh?
That's our bet. Yeah.
Yeah.
Science is progressive. Science moves forward. The problem is that it doesn't move forward at a steady and consistent rate in a steady and consistent trajectory. It moves in fits, spurts, and it goes in different directions, and where it ends, nobody knows. When you have had a long period of relative calm, and then some breakthroughs occur, it's going to disrupt. It's going to be very difficult for people. People are going to experience that and resist and push back and say, we were doing just fine the way things were. Why are you introducing these new terms? Why are you introducing these new procedures? If science were perfect and continued along a steady trajectory in a consistent direction, then new developments would be well socialized into like, this is how we do what we do. We keep changing, we keep growing, we keep evolving. That would be nice, but that's not the way things are. So it is a little bit disruptive when something very new enters. Yeah. And ACT is not very new, but it's new to applied behavior analysis. I think you asked this earlier and I never really had a chance to answer it. I think that applied behavior analysis had to, for all good reasons, narrow its focus. Mm-hmm. If you read Don Baer's writing on why he narrowed his focus, it makes sense. There was limited technology at the time. There was the presence of externalities which could squash behavior analysis and stop our right to practice. So by limiting what we did in North America, it assured our right to practice, even if in limited context. And so we've gradually kind of been trying to move that out. And, you know, ever since I've been around, there's been calls to behavior analysts to get outside of autism and get outside of developmental disabilities.
Yeah.
for schools, but it's been hard to make that happen economically. I think that these technologies now will make it more possible for us to do that, to be relevant in other branches of the applied domain. This seems to be the right place to start. It seems to me the right place to start because there's just enough exposure to RFT inside of what we do in Capture a Cloud that you get a sense for how it all fits together. Mm-hmm. And then there's other courses you can take. So a couple of my colleagues are developing a online RFT course that we'll offer through ActNow ABA, and we'll offer other online courses as well as other in-person courses down the road that kind of fill in the gaps. Like, so I have taught pro-social courses in the past, and I have taught RFT courses in the past. And so those will kind of come in as we move forward. But right now, the most important thing for me is to make sure that ACT is a standard part of everybody's toolkit, that you use when it's used to use it, that you don't use when you don't need to use it, but that it is a accepted part of the toolkit that applied behavior analysts have at their disposal. And that is not to cast any shadows on nonlinear contingency analysis approaches or equivalence-based teaching approaches. It doesn't seem to me like it is an exclusionary world. Yeah. There's a mountain that we're all climbing. Why do we all have to climb the same path? There's many different paths to get to the summit and to get down safely.
Yeah. Yeah, but if you're working with verbally able individuals, it is really important that ACT be part of that repertoire. And I like the fact that you are now you're leading the way to for and legitimizing that for behavior analysts to use that in their toolkit, because it's so important as part of their toolkit. Now, there's so many people who are in need of that, who are verbally able and do not respond just to direct contingency trainings.
You know what? Maybe I would modify that just a little bit and say it's very, very important that there's something there that addresses the treatment failures that we get with typical differential reinforcement of reinforcement. Yeah. Procedures. Yeah. And if you're able to apply nonlinear contingency analysis and get into somebody's world and find out what are the wacky contingencies to which they're responding, awesome. There's alternatives. There are equivalence-based approaches. There are ACT-based approaches that, I mean, I just don't see the world as a this way or the highway place. I see the world as there's many different paths that we might take, but we need to take a path. We certainly can't keep doing what we did and getting the same results, because the results are good, but they're not fantastic. Let's keep moving towards the light fantastic.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you, Tom, so much for being part of this. The training, again, the company, actnowaba.com. You can you don't have to be a member of the website, correct? You can just sign up for the training that way through there. And the training is called Capture a Cloud, a 4-day workshop intensive in Las Vegas, Nevada. Starting January 11th through the 14th, set up now for early bird special. Contact Tom, and I'll put up your contact information for pricing, and also your manual. Very important. Just came out in October. It's called ACT and Applied Behavior Analysis. Yes, thank you. Thank you so much, Tom. I appreciate your time.
And, thanks for having me.
Yeah, glad to have you. So good luck with the trainings. Good luck with the company. And we'll be in touch soon.
All right. Thanks, you. Bye-bye. Spit on the ground, hold your breath. Try to scare yourself to death. Bury your bones under the dirt and tear your heart and rip your shirt. And stomp your feet in disgust. Curse the gray skies if you must. But you'll find when you are done. Blue skies for everyone.